From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. More and more, the news from Iraq brings word not just of insurgent attacks on passersby in daylight, but of targeted violence in the shadows, midnight abductions by men in uniforms, death squads, some say, with ties to the Shiite-dominated interior ministry. On Wednesday, 50 members of a Sunni security company were kidnapped in such a raid. In a separate incident that day, police found 24 bodies in Baghdad, all of them strangled or shot at close range.
On Thursday, an article in the Washington Post claimed that a cover-up was underway. According to an unnamed health ministry official, the government's majority Shiite party had ordered the health ministry to stop counting execution-style shootings and tally only deaths by bombing and other insurgent attacks. If true, it explains the Post's earlier report that more than 1,300 Iraqis had been killed in sectarian fighting after the bombing of the Shiite shrine in Samarra. That controversial number came from officials at Baghdad's morgue, but it was immediately denied by the morgue's director and by Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari, who put the number at 379. Ellen Nickmeyer, the Post reporter who wrote both stories, was less surprised by the disparity in the death toll than by the failure of other journalists to check it out.
I was kind of surprised that more people didn't go to the morgue to see for themselves after what we all knew was 5 or 6 days of stepped-up violence here in Baghdad. A lot of the killings now, they happen at night, and they're one by one where people are taken from homes and they wind up dead someplace. And that's the easiest kind of killing to miss. We reported that the health ministry official claiming that the orders to minimize the casualties came during the weekend of the worst of violence.
And that was the official who told you later, no, please forget what I said.
That's right. Yeah, we went back for more information. He said, I'm not going to talk to you and forget what I said. Iraq is pretty lawless now, and the people who stick their necks out do put themselves in danger here, yeah.
We're speaking on Thursday. As I read your piece this morning, it struck me as a kind of microcosm of all of the problems of reporting from Iraq at the moment, where, you know, all information is as much a weapon of the various warring parties as, you know, bullets and bombs themselves. Does that kind of complicate life for you there?
In a way, Iraq's government has been strangely open, especially when you consider the fact that it's coming out of the Saddam era when, you know, every bit of information was treated as state property and was only released if there was approval from higher-ups. I mean, officials have actually been pretty forthcoming, and our access to stories has actually been good. I mean, one of the problems is that the government is fragmented, and ministries are fragmented, and there's lots and lots of infighting going on. And I don't get the sense that the government itself really has a handle on what's going on in all of Baghdad, let alone, you know, in cities just outside Baghdad or all of Iraq.
It sounds like some sort of grim good news, bad news joke. The good news is people are forthcoming with information. The bad news is it might not be true.
I guess so. That's why it's always important in any situation you're in, especially in wars, to go out and see the situation for yourself. And, you know, that's kind of what we did when we've gone back and forth to the morgue and we've gone back and forth to the health ministry. Say, show me the records. Show me how you break down the deaths. We went to the morgue the day after the mosque bombing and saw that there had already been substantially more bodies brought in than the government later indicated. And I went back to the morgue the day the curfew was lifted so I could see for myself the situation there.
What did you see? I mean, were you actually counting bodies?
I wasn't allowed in the morgue myself. I was looking in the door, but I wasn't allowed to enter the door. They had a computer screen set up where relatives could see pictures of the dead and try to identify the dead. And the bodies I saw all had been killed violently. Some of them had been strangled. Some of them had plastic bags over their head. Lots of them had their hands tied in front of them or behind their back. It was a pretty dramatic scene. There were lots of bodies there.
But there was no way, based on your eyewitness reporting, to know whether there were, you know, 100 or 1,300?
There was no way, but later on putting together the numbers of the capacity of the morgue, I mean, they had to bring in refrigerated trucks to handle the dead, and their capacity is somewhere around 300 at a minimum. So their numbers that they say they handled over the 6 days of the worst of the violence after the bombing of the mosque don't fit with the situation at the morgue.
If you're right, and the majority of the violence at this point is being perpetrated by Shiite militias, and if there's a stranglehold on good information, are we in the coming weeks and months going to actually know less and less about what's going on there?
I'm afraid, because of the attention paid to the morgue, that it's going to be more difficult to get numbers out of the morgue. We were only getting a part of the picture as it is, and maybe we're going to be getting a smaller part after this.
Ellen Nickmeyer is Baghdad Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Well, Ellen, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
On Thursday, a research group called Iraq Body Count issued findings that show the rate of civilian deaths rising each year since May 1, 2003, when the president announced the end of combat operations. According to the group, in the first year, violent death occurred at a rate of 20 per day. In year two, 31 per day. And in 2006, so far, 36 per day. And that doesn't count the carnage following the attack on the Shiite mosque in Samarra. Since Iraq Body Count relies entirely on media reports for its figures, we wondered how the Washington Post's assertion that the death toll is being suppressed would affect its work. Scott Lipscomb is a researcher and U.S. spokesman for Iraq Body Count. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what happens when there's only one source for a reported incident and it's highly contentious or even rejected by other news outlets, as in the Washington Post case?
In the case where we had a single media report that stated a specific number, for instance, the 1,300 figure that was reported in the Washington Post, would need to be corroborated by a second media outlet.
But what if the Washington Post got something of a scoop when it found out that the morgues may actually be undercutting the figures that everybody uses, that they're leaving out the execution-style deaths? We don't know whether that's true yet, but if it is, and if the Washington Post found it out, then you're not likely to get a second source to corroborate it. Do you then still just ignore it?
That's true. And we don't rely only on morgue reports, of course. So we have multiple sources. And when a report like the figures from the morgue comes out, what we then do is go back and compare individual incidents that we have corroborated in the Baghdad area in this instance that would overlap that particular incident, and we would factor those out before we would add any kind of a morgue figure in. And so our figures actually don't rely on these big released figures exclusively.
If you've got numbers from the morgue, which have customarily been higher, but now suddenly may well be lower or as low as the official count, what does all this mean for the prospects of getting a grip on the real human cost of this war?
Getting a real grip on the cost of the war is a very difficult issue, period. And when instances occur where there are varying accounts that are both corroborated, we have a minimum figure and a maximum figure. Now understand that at Iraq Body Count, we only report the number of deaths that find their way into the media. And so I would argue that the numbers on our website are always an undercount.
Well, let's talk about your methodology. According to your website, your tally includes, quote, civilian deaths caused by coalition military action and by military or paramilitary responses to the coalition presence, that is to say, insurgent or terrorist attacks. So how far do you extend this chain of causation that begins with the coalition presence?
Essentially, any person who is killed as a result of a bombing, of a terrorist action, or execution-style murders, which appears to be the case here with the morgue figure that was released, those would certainly count in our tally.
But if the situation devolves, for instance, into all-out civil war, as many suggest may be happening right now, can we fairly blame that on the U.S. occupation? What if the U.S. military tomorrow were to pull out altogether? All the indications are that the killing might continue just as ferociously as now, if not more so.
Ultimately, this exact situation could have been predicted that, in fact, we would not be greeted with flowers and we would not be welcomed into the country. So this current situation is a direct result of the decision to invade Iraq. 37,589 individuals, innocent civilians, have died. That is a horrifically tragic figure and one that really the American people need to be aware of.
Would you regard Iraq Body Count as a political organization as much as a research organization?
I would refer to us as a humanitarian organization made up of researchers. We don't really have a direct political message, although we are certainly opposed to the current occupation in Iraq.
It does sound like a direct political message.
Our goal is to simply systematically and very carefully log the number of civilian casualties that are documented by the media, tabulate a total, and put it on a website so that that can be communicated around the world.
Have any foreign governments or any official bodies criticized the work that Iraq Body Count is doing?
To my knowledge, there's not been a specific instance in which a government or organization at that level has come and specifically focused on our work, except to the extent that George Bush recently referred to a figure of 30,000, and then Scott McClellan later confirmed that that number was associated with our website.
Do you worry with such reports as that in the Washington Post this week, that your job is only going to get harder and may in fact become impossible?
It's never been easy. It will certainly make it more difficult to get reliable figures if, in fact, organizations that have precise numbers and have exact information are influenced in a way that causes them not to release those numbers accurately.
All right. Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott Lipscomb is an assistant researcher for IraqBodyCount.net. We spoke to him from Northwestern University.
And now a correction. Last week, in a piece about military vets running for Congress as Democrats, Brooks said the Democratic leadership has thrown its weight behind just one of those candidates, Tammy Duckworth. Sarah Feinberg of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee tells us that her group has in fact helped the campaigns of several of those candidates. Plus, she says the Democratic leadership did not ignore the campaign of veteran Paul Hackett last summer, as we said, but provided both field and political support.
Coming up, AT&T's age-old battle with a fictional battle axe, Ernestine.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week we learned of the imminent merger of AT&T and Bell South. If the deal goes through, the newly reconstituted AT&T would provide 22 states with local phone service and would be a giant in the areas of data transmission and especially wireless communication. This is, of course, not your father's AT&T. In 1984, that company was broken up into seven Baby Bells and a long-distance and equipment company. But the Telecommunications Act of 1996 allowed the business to partly reconsolidate, and eventually AT&T was bought by one of its babies, Southwestern Bell, which took its parents' name. Now the Telecommunications Act is being overhauled yet again, and we'll get into that in a few minutes. But first, we'll take a closer look at one of the burning issues under review, one that concerns both AT&T and anyone who uses the Internet, namely the issue of network neutrality.
At the moment, all online information travels at roughly the same speed. In other words, a page from eBay travels at the same rate as a porn site photo. But Internet watchdogs are warning that some data could encounter some speed bumps because Internet service providers may soon be charging content providers for access to the fast lane. AT&T Chairman Ed Whitaker put it bluntly in November when he complained that content providers like Google were getting a free ride, saying, "They use my lines for free, and that's bull." Internet advocacy groups are outraged. They claim that the Internet's current, quote, network neutrality is crucial to its egalitarian nature and innovative spirit. Their concern has reached Washington, sparking FCC and congressional hearings on the issue. Christopher Stern is a media policy analyst with Medley Global Advisors in D.C., and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
So let's say Internet service providers start offering preferential treatment to certain websites. Give us a worst case scenario. How profoundly could it change the Internet?
Well, the worst case scenario, of course, is that you don't get access to information that you've been getting access to today, that you prefer Google, but all of a sudden you find that it's too slow and that you're finding that Yahoo is supercharged and you get there whatever you want from Yahoo much quicker. That worst case scenario is something that could play out over several years. It doesn't have to happen tomorrow.
Do you think that, you know, the AT&Ts of the world have any point at all when they're charging that the Googles and Yahoos are really getting a free ride? Because if you look at it from another angle, Google has to pay some Internet provider to have their services connected to the Internet. And beyond that, Google doesn't use the Internet service provider's bandwidth. We're the ones that use it to get to Google. And we pay the Internet service providers a monthly fee to use it. So aren't the ISPs actually getting paid twice already?
Well, you bring up a really interesting point. And I think the thing that fascinates me about this is some of the consumer advocates are saying, this is the wrong way to go about it. Don't charge Google. Don't charge Yahoo. Charge the consumer. As a consumer, I can decide whether I want speeds of, you know, 20 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour when it comes to accessing the Internet. That way, if you're an Internet service provider, your hand's off the dial and everybody stays pretty much on an even keel. But the fact is that Google and Yahoo or MSN, they do pay an incremental increase with traffic. But the AT&Ts of the world don't capture that value when they suddenly start moving a certain amount of megabits from MSN to a much larger. It's an incremental capture of value, not a wholesale one.
So what you're saying is the Googles are getting a better deal out of this than the AT&Ts are.
Yeah, and that's been part of the deal all along.
Do you suspect that if this scenario played out, or if you could pay for a faster track through your Internet service provider, that this would leave out the little guy who now gets to work on a level playing field?
I think that's the big fear, and it's certainly the argument that the advocates for net neutrality are using. They're saying not only the little guy, the new innovator, the next Google, the next Yahoo, won't be able to get onto the Internet because there'll be on-ramps that will cost a fee. This is the soul of the net neutrality debate, is whether or not we continue with a network that is completely doesn't care who you are, where you are in terms of providing service, to one that the owners of the network will put their finger on the scale and pick favorites and decide who gets there a little bit faster.
There are a lot of Internet watchdogs that are concerned that one ISP or another could really dominate the market and determine what goes on in it. This is a common scenario. Could they outright block content from any place they wanted, you know, essentially cutting off a part of the Internet to a whole area?
No, that's one thing that's been made pretty clear by the FCC in an earlier ruling. No ISP is allowed to block somebody from reaching a legal website or from reaching a legal service. There was a case where a small telephone company was trying to block access to a voice-over internet protocol service or rival service that allowed people to make calls over the internet. And the FCC shut that down and fined that company, saying, you've got to allow people to reach the services and use the internet in the way they want to use it. So we're not going to see blocking. The question is, are we going to see a little influencing of one website or one service getting there a little bit faster than the next one? The bottom line is, I think that the government has to protect, either through rulings or through legislation, that the internet remains a commercial meritocracy and that the best players rise to the top, not because of their commercial affiliations, but because of how they do their work and how they perform and how accessible they are to customers.
All right. Christopher, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Christopher Stern is the media policy analyst with Medley Global Advisors.
For months, lawmakers in the Commerce Committee have been laboring over an update to the 1996 Telecommunications Act, but in recent weeks, the intended overhaul seems to have shriveled into a minor revision, as such issues as network neutrality and video franchising, which we'll get into in a minute, slide on and off the table. Now, committee members are weighing the power of the baby bells, not quite babies anymore, against the power of public pressure. David Hatch, a reporter for Congress Daily, has been watching this play out on Capitol Hill.
Well, there's a lot of interesting politicking and horse trading going on. The House Commerce Committee, which is headed by Representative Joe Barton, a Republican of Texas, has been negotiating for several months on this legislation. Network neutrality is said to still be on the table, and in particular, in the wake of the announcement that AT&T plans to merge with Bell South, the ante has been upped here, and there's a lot more attention on the issue. And there are other issues that are also at play, including the issue of video franchising. And that has to do with the Bell companies seeking regulatory relief so that they can enter the video programming marketplace.
Well, let's start with that one, because I can actually see both sides of the argument.
Sure. Basically, the Bell companies are saying, we have an opportunity to help lower prices, but we need the help of the government. They want to be put under either a nationwide franchise that would be uniform throughout the country or perhaps statewide franchises. The phone companies would still pay the fees and the money would still go to localities. But the phone companies would not have to negotiate with potentially thousands of local governments in order to be able to bring their video programming to different communities. And the cable industry has been balking, basically saying, look, there should be a level playing field. We had to secure local franchises throughout the country. The Bell should have to get them too.
Now, the phone companies are not passive witnesses to what's going on. They have been very active lobbying Congress and have paid big money over the years to the very principals, notably Joe Barton and the Democrat John Dingell, who are the architects of this legislation. What effect has all that money had on the way this law is being drafted?
Well, there's no question that the Bells bring tremendous lobbying muscle to the table here. It should be noted that John Dingell, the ranking Democrat on the committee, historically has been known as somebody who has fairly close ties to the Bells. Both he and Mr. Barton have received a lot of money from the Bells over the years. And as a matter of fact, it was a top lobbyist with Verizon, Tom Talkie, who started talking several weeks ago about a streamlined video franchising bill. And lo and behold, we started hearing that that was the direction that the committee was moving in. But again, I think in the wake of this merger, there's a lot more emphasis on network neutrality. There's a lot more attention on it. And there's a feeling out there that the House Commerce Committee might be a little hesitant to be the ones who leave that completely out of legislation, that they don't want to be blamed for various substantive changes to the internet that might result.
Well, let's talk about that merger for a moment, because those of us of a certain age remember when, before the court-ordered 1984 breakup of AT&T, it was Ma Bell. You know, it was the quintessence of the gigantic institution over which the poor customer had no leverage. Will this merger, which appears to be headed for approval, will that put political pressure on the phone companies that could hurt them in the outcome of whatever legislation gets drafted?
I think it could. I think now there's a lot more at stake. There would only be three Bell companies that would be left if this merger goes through. Of course, the Bells would paint a very different picture. They would argue that they're facing all sorts of new competitors that did not exist years ago with the emergence of cell phones and internet telephony and even free internet-based telephone services such as Skype cutting into their market share. So they're really looking to broaden their businesses.
On the subject of competition, there is one potential competitor out there for all broadband providers, and that is actual municipal governments, notably Philadelphia, which has floated the idea, at least, of bringing broadband at very low cost to everyone within the city limits. There was talk at one point of that kind of issue being addressed in the telecommunications bill. Is it going to be?
It's definitely an issue that's being addressed by Congress. There are several bills that have been introduced. There are some measures that would restrict the ability of municipalities to offer broadband service. There are other bills that would ensure that no restrictions aren't placed on municipalities. It doesn't look like that issue is going to be part of the House Commerce legislation that's being considered at the moment. The sense is that if there's going to be legislation this year on telecom and media issues, it's probably going to focus on video franchising. It may include network neutrality. I'm not sure if they're going to get to municipal broadband this year.
All right, David. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Hatch is a reporter for several national journal publications, including Congress Daily.
For years, even when it was a near monopoly, AT&T managed to do the impossible with a surprising degree of success. It managed to convince us that a huge corporation could be our friend.
That's just the way your dad used to hit him.
As I said, over the years, they managed this PR coup with a surprising degree of success, but not complete success. There was no denying the control that company had over our lives, which is why Ernestine, the telephone operator embodied by Lily Tomlin on the 1960s TV show Laugh-In, was so beloved.
Mr. Beadle, it's me again. We seem to be disconnected. Now, Mr. Beadle, I want you to understand something. We are not subject to city, state, or federal regulations. We are omnipotent. Omnipotent. That's potent with an omni in front of it.
She captured a theme that had been around for about a century of resistance or irritation with the telephone company.
Claude Fisher is a sociology professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of A Social History of the Telephone. He says that AT&T has long contended with two views of itself— Ernestine's and the cozier one it wants to project. But he says if you go back a century, you find that reaching out and touching someone was the last thing on AT&T's mind. In fact, it actively opposed what it called idle chatter.
They would put notices in telephone directories about what the proper use of the telephone was, which was functional and quick and get off. That was the message for about the first half century of the history of the telephone, and it starts to change in the 1920s. When AT&T decides that they could actually make money by getting people to put in telephones and subscribe by making it a social device.
They just came to the conclusion that if people bought the phone and used it more, that they would make money?
The change in attitude, I think, occurs in a couple of ways. One is the realization that the automobile and other technologies, but notably the automobile, was making a far greater advance in the United States in the 1920s than the telephone. And one feature of the automobile in its early years, we don't think about it so much this way, is it was a leisure device. It was a device mostly for going out and having a good time. They always knew that customers tended to behave in this undesirable way of calling up friends and just sort of chatting away and gossiping and so forth on the phone. But they start to think that maybe this was something to encourage. And I think the major change was actually a changeover in the personnel that headed AT&T. The old line telephone people come out of the telegraph business. The new leaders of AT&T came from places like marketing or journalism. One of the new leaders of AT&T made a speech at a private conference saying that they'd been wrong all these years trying to suppress social conversation on the phone. He said it's as if the automobile industry had tried to tell customers, don't drive your car on Sundays, only use it to go to work.
Now, you write in your book that AT&T led the development of public relations in America, and part of the reason why is because it had to survive or overcome the image of being a huge monopoly with great tentacles, the Bell octopus, so to speak.
That's right. They really pioneered public relations. One way they did it in an early part of the century was to use an outfit out of Boston called the Publicity Bureau, whose job it was to plant newspaper stories around the country, casting the telephone company in a good light. These stories included items on how operators had saved lives, or how repairmen had worked through blizzards, or how churches were finding new ways to use the telephone. Later on, in 1907 on, they engaged in large-scale advertising campaigns. They would put ads in prominent places with a message that the telephone industry was a service to the public, particularly AT&T, because it was so universal, it covered so much of the country. The kind of Lily Tomlin message always was in the background and always created some kind of tension. But over the years, the phone company did try very much to use what we now take for granted, PR, just creating good feelings about the company. That and making some concessions to public demand for telephones and to public regulation enabled the company to last very long into the 20th century.
But now that there is another company, it's not the same company, but another company with the same name, AT&T, will we see a resurgence of the same sort of widespread suspicion as that company gets bigger and bigger?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. The environment is different, of course, with internet communications, email, cable, and so forth. And the proponents of the AT&T merger can argue that it no longer has quite the free hand it did. But I suspect that the larger the company gets, the more this is going to be a tension they have to deal with, dealing with politicians and dealing with voters. And I suspect that we'll see more and more advertisements on television and so forth dedicated to the proposition that the larger AT&T works for the greater good of the greatest number.
Claude Fisher, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Claude Fisher is a sociology professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of A Social History of the Telephone.
Oh, Mr. Beadle, I'm afraid we're going to have to discontinue your outgoing service. And if we do not receive payment within 10 days, we will send a large, burly serviceman to your home to rip it out of the wall. I'd advise you to lock up the liquor. He's a mean drunk. Mr. Beadle, wouldn't you really rather pay than lose your service and possibly the use of one eye?
Up next, they write dead people, reporters on the Obit Beat, and the Da Vinci Code's Day in Court.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week saw the death of the Malian guitarist Ali Farkatore, the photographer and filmmaker Gordon Parks, and the actor and stem cell activist Dana Reeve. It's likely the three never met, but there they were on Wednesday, sharing the intimate space of the obituary page. It is these strange conjunctions and the details of lesser-known lives that fuel the obsession of many obituary readers. Marilyn Johnson is one of them. She's penned obituaries of Johnny Cash and Marlon Brando, and she's written a book about the form called The Deadbeat. Johnson argues that obituaries demand the most creative writing in journalism because so much is conveyed in so few words.
And that is one reason that I think obituary writing is so incredibly demanding. You're doing it in this tight form. You are trying to capture a life. You're trying to bring someone back for a curtain call, essentially. And you're trying to make it all accurate. You're doing that in the span of a couple of hours. I think it's an incredible act of writing. One thing that I found very interesting is that there are young writers going into the obituary field and going into it, leaning into it with incredible wit and skills.
So there was a time not too long ago when everybody wanted to get into the business to be Woodward and Bernstein. Now people are coming into the business hoping someday to bury Woodward and Bernstein.
Well, you know, you get to talk about everything under the sun. You get to cast your eye on whole eras and try to sum them up. Try to say what the impact of Johnny Cash was on music. I mean, these are big, juicy topics, and you can pretend all you want that you're just stringing the facts out, you know, chasing down dead people. But in fact, what you are doing is writing our history.
Give us a brief history of this history recording process. How has the form evolved?
There were some very flowery ones that you could read in, for instance, the 19th century, with wonderful details and fabulous death scenes. Tolstoy's death is rather more specific than you would want to hear about. That used to be in the newspaper. Things got very cut and dried in the 20th century. There you would find obits of white men who belonged to a lot of clubs and had a lot of degrees and left survivors. And you would see basically strings of facts.
I was struck by one quote from Gay Talese, who said that 40 years ago, women and Negroes hardly ever seemed to die. When did that begin to change?
It's hard to say in things like that because there are little newspapers across the country where people were sending off their neighbors with real affection and detail. But in the big city papers, you saw that turning in the early 80s. Jim Nicholson, you know, he was a burnt-out newspaper man. He filled the old model of somebody sent to the obit desk. He was writing for the Philadelphia Daily News, which had a nickname, the People's Paper. And so he thought, and his managing editor thought, the heck with the famous people. They're being well covered by the Inquirer. Let's go write about the people who actually read our newspaper. He had the ability to both inhabit the world he was writing about and give it perspective. Quote, they were married 3 months later and not because they had to. Quote, he was a good pool player, had an eye for women, never broke his word. Quote, it was one hot day when she watched her oldest son, Thad, plowing, that she decided her children wouldn't spend their lives following a mule through the South Carolina dirt.
I gather there are two schools of obituary writing. There's the American school, which is approximately straightforward, and then the British school, which seems to take a very different path into the lives of the recently departed.
They love to sit around and be savage, and so if they have the opportunity, they'll make the joke. Here's one that appeared in the Daily Telegraph. They have particular savage fun there. Carly Simon probably wrote You're So Vain not about James Taylor or Warren Beatty or Mick Jagger, but about the dissipated eccentric William Donaldson, who left her when she was still quite naive. Donaldson wrote wonderful satirical books, but he also ran through several fortunes, pimped, and enjoyed crack cocaine and the date rape drug Rohypnol. He liked to use it on himself. It's such a nuisance, the Daily Telegraph quoted him in his obit. The trouble is, it wipes your memory. You have to video yourself to appreciate just what a good time you had.
British obits have become famous for their use of euphemism. Can you read from your list?
I had the pleasure of sitting in an audience in England and hearing Hugh Massingbird, who is the father of the witchy obit, give me some of the euphemisms himself. Gave colorful accounts of his exploits. Liar. No discernible enthusiasm for civil rights. Nazi. Affable and hospitable at every hour. Chronic alcoholic. Fun-loving and flirtatious. Nymphomaniac. An uncompromisingly direct ladies' man. Flasher and rapist. They use this all the time.
May I not die in England? That's all I can say. Okay, now that's surprising and probably quite illuminating, but eulogies are supposed to recall the best of us. If you've just buried William Donaldson and you pick up the Daily Telegraph, aren't these newspapers, you know, besieged by angry mourners with flaming torches?
I don't know that they're not particularly, but it's interesting. I mean, why do you presume that we should be hushed and respectful? That's definitely an American bias. We're conditioned to throw our hands over our heart and speak only good words about the dead. I don't think that's something that people are presuming so much anymore. And why should it be? They're gone.
Marilyn, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Marilyn Johnson is the author of The Deadbeat, published by HarperCollins.
You and I, Robert, we have observed history. We are in history now.
That's a clip from the upcoming film The Da Vinci Code, based on the best-selling novel. This week, the novelist Dan Brown and his publisher Random House were in a London courtroom defending themselves against charges of copyright infringement. Authors Michael Bagent and Richard Lee say that The Da Vinci Code borrowed a little too much from their work of speculative nonfiction, The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. Catherine Rushton reports for The Bookseller, and she was in the courtroom this week. Catherine, could you set the scene?
Well, it's been an interesting week, although I would say a difficult one for the claimants. Michael Bagent has been in the witness box for most of the week, and actually he's had to retract a lot of the points in his witness statement on the cross-examination and been forced to admit that a lot of the material he has claimed copyright for actually appeared in other sources that Dan Brown could have got it from.
And tell me what's at stake in this case.
Well, I suppose for Dan Brown, not only is a lot of money at stake in the film of his book, but also his credibility. Whereas for Liam Bagent, they stand to gain a lot of money and a lot of credibility if they win this case.
This case obviously is happening in Britain, but are there ramifications for authors here in the United States?
I imagine so. I think it's been taken in Britain because our copyright law is slightly different and they think it would be easier to pursue here. But if they do establish that Dan Brown infringed their copyright, presumably they would then follow that up in the US and try and achieve the same ruling, in which case it would become difficult for fiction authors to use historical works.
Are they going to win this case?
Without a doubt, no.
Catherine, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Catherine Rushton reports for The Bookseller. Writers of historical fiction are watching this case with great interest. Among them is Sarah Dunant, a former journalist. Her most recent novel, set in Renaissance Italy, is In the Company of the Courtesan, also a Random House title. She's on the phone from London. Sarah, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Brooke. Pleased to be with you.
Now, one question we had is, what exactly is historical fiction? Is it a fictionalizing of a historical event, or is it simply fiction that takes place in some historical epoch?
Well, the answer is it can be either or both, although I suspect it can't be neither of the two. I think probably by definition, historical fiction is always a mixture of fiction and fact.
In the back of your most recent book, In the Company of the Courtesan, you actually have a bibliography. What sorts of sources did you consult?
Well, I spent probably about a year researching in the company of the courtesan. You know, the fact is, Brooke, if I were to try and write from scratch a novel set in 16th century Florence without using other people's work for some of my facts, it would take me 250 lifetimes to do. So, of course, I need scholars who have done the work.
Okay, but that established, what about the scenarios that they may speculate on? In the Dan Brown case, they're talking about a speculation that Christ might have survived and gone on to father child. Obviously, this isn't about fact gathering. This is about perhaps borrowing a scenario.
I think the problem about religion is it is based somewhere on a series of facts that nobody quite knows. The notion that Christ may have been married, the notion that Mary Magdalene may have been more than just a poor supplicant, are notions that have been around for a very long time. And if a writer, particularly a thriller writer, i.e. a writer where plot is really important, where the uncovering of secrets is really important, you know, I began life as a thriller writer and I try and weave in thriller plots to history, because the better the book, the more you're drawing on stuff that is actually fact. Thriller writers do lots of research. The big question here is whether or not an idea, a bigger idea, as opposed to a series of facts and opinions, can be copyrighted. And that is a huge question, which I think even when they have ordered one way or the other in the Dan Brown case, in a sense, we'll still be asking.
So far in the Da Vinci Code case, it isn't going very well for the plaintiffs, who seem to have exaggerated the amount of borrowing that was done in the case of the Da Vinci Code. Also, Dan Brown evidently conceded right from the start that he'd consulted their work, among others. And one of the plaintiffs said, quote, "The Da Vinci Code uses the tips of the icebergs that were produced by the research that we did." It seems that the tips of the icebergs ought to be accessible to everybody, right?
Oh, and you've put your finger on something so interesting about this present moment in writing stuff about history, too. For a very long time, any kind of novel about history, particularly deliberately historical novels, were more often about kind of kings and queens and big battles and the big accepted history. But the kind of history that has been done by all manner of scholars over the last 40 or 50 years, from women research people to people who are interested in gay culture to people who are interested in the hidden bits of the sort of Christian mythology, their job has been to get under the surface, to get to those other 9/10 of the iceberg. It's all, in a sense, new and slightly hidden history. So the historical novelist, particularly if you want to write a good thrilling historical novel, which I certainly set out to do, has to use all kinds of sources, which in a sense are just the tip of the iceberg. Now, all I can say is that as a historical novelist writing about Venice in this period, every time I used a book which had either a series of facts I didn't know, which had come from a PhD or a master's thesis, to a kind of recipe for how women lightened their skin, I put down the name of the book and I put it in the bibliography. And that, in a sense, is to guard myself against the feeling that I have ripped off or stolen something. Now, it may be that part of the process of writing this is you just do absorb a huge amount of information, which is factual, and then it goes through the alchemy of fiction and the imagination and comes out with some similarities and some differences. But now you're talking about a process so subtle, which is a process of the imagination, and I just don't know how you can legislate for it in a way that stands up in a court of law.
Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. Take care. Bye-bye.
Sarah Dunant's most recent book is In the Company of the Courtesan, set in Renaissance Italy.
We may be fairly accused of beating up on cable news, but it's hard to resist when cable news beats up on itself. Case in point, the O'Reilly-Olbermann Smackdown. Keith Olbermann, host of MSNBC's Countdown, has a weekly segment called The Worst Person in the World, and frequently awards that honor to Bill O'Reilly of Fox's O'Reilly Factor. Recently, O'Reilly cracked. He said anyone who spoke Olbermann's name on his program would hear from Fox Security, and apparently at least one caller to his radio show already has. We gathered actual tape of the feuding hosts, set their voices to music, and yes, embellished the tale just a little. Think of it as behind the music for cable news nerds.
Like all MC rivalries, at the heart of the battle between Olbermann and O'Reilly is money, fame, and street cred. Their cable news shows compete for the 8 p.m. slot. Ultimately, the success of one hinges on the destruction of the other.
I think the real war began when Keith started calling him Ted Baxter. And then he included O'Reilly in the worst person segment 16 times. 16 times! I told him, Keith, you're declaring war. And he just laughed. I tried to warn him.
O'Reilly banned anyone from mentioning Olbermann's name on his show. Things turned ugly when Mike from Orlando called into O'Reilly's radio show and tried to mention Olbermann. Mike's line was cut, and a few days later, the O'Reilly crew released the chilling single, He's a Gone Guy.
You're in the no-spin zone with Bill O'Reilly.
Believe it. We have your phone numbers, by the way. Believe it. Because we're not going to play around. You will be held accountable. Believe it. So if you're listening, Mike, we have your phone number, and we're going to turn it over to Fox Security, and you'll be getting a little visit. Believe it. No, maybe Mike's going to get in big trouble. There you go. Mike is, he's a gone guy.
In the track, O'Reilly and his crew threaten to sic Fox Security on anyone who gets in their way. Shepard Smith makes an eerie cameo at the end of the cut.
He's a gone guy. Believe it.
No, O'Reilly's angry. Where's Olbermann? Let's just throw something at Olbermann, Bill.
The O'Reilly crew performed He's a Gone Guy 2 weeks later at the Peabody's in front of an amped-up crowd of broadcast executives.
I think we showed old B that we meant business. I mean, come on, they're on MSNBC. Who do they think they are?
But old B, as he now goes by, fired back with his own song, Threatening Behavior. He openly mocked the O'Reilly crew, further feeding the flames.
Oh, here we go.
Cut him off. Expurgated. Erased. It's a radio show. Even if a caller swears, it's a radio show. What do you mean you'll be getting a little visit? What do you mean we have your phone numbers? Bill thinks he has his own police. Radio show over here. Trip to Gitmo over there. Why are you always smearing him, Bill?
That is an abuse of Bill O'Reilly's power, and it's an attempt. He's crossed the line. It's an abuse of the media, it's an abuse of law enforcement, and he's now the one engaging in threatening behavior.
At a Peabody after party, violence broke out when O'Reilly's Fox Security roughed up Olby's posse. No one was wounded, but a producer's dress was damaged, and Olby's hair was mussed.
Keith's hair just didn't have to get mussed like that. Keith's hair is great. I wish it hadn't gone down this way.
As we said, those were the voices of the actual hosts. We made up the songs and the part about the Peabodys.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Mixmaster Mark Phillips, Ani Katz, Andy Lancet, and Arun Roth. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist-composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org, and thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour.
There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.